Hello, and welcome to the Conduit podcast. I'm Rosie Fletcher, the editorial manager at the Conduit, a collaborative community dedicated to building a just, prosperous, and sustainable future. When Canadian ecologist Suzanne Simard discovered how trees communicate through fungal networks, her findings were dismissed and ridiculed. But today, she is world-renowned for transforming our understanding of the lives of forests. She was the inspiration for one of the protagonists in Richard Powers' magnificent novel, The Overstory. And Amy Adams is set to play her in a forthcoming movie of her life. Suzanne has just published a memoir called Finding the Mother Tree. And on a recent trip to the UK, she joined author and traveller Sophie Roberts to tell her story live at the Conduit. The event was held in partnership with the How To Academy, London's home of big thinking. Listeners can also find the How To Academy podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever they get their podcasts. Go and check them out for many more inspiring conversations. Here are Sophie and Suzanne.
I would like to start by asking you to draw a picture of your home, of that forest where your roots begin.
Yeah, so imagine the west coast of British Columbia with this huge Pacific Ocean that's kind of, it's very tumultuous. It sweeps across the continent and hits a whole bunch of mountains. And those mountains are the Western Cordilleran of North America. And where I'm from, British Columbia, is the most mountainous part. And that weather slams into those mountains, rises up, and rains like crazy. And that rain feeds these absolutely magnificent forests. These are the West Coast rainforests. They're some of the most magnificent forests of the world. They're equally as precious as the Amazon and the Congo. I know you've written about the Congo. They're as precious as the Indonesian rainforests, because they're so diverse and they're so productive. And you can imagine, and probably many of you have been there, these trees that live to thousands of years old, they can be 2,000 years old, 3,000 years old, easily when they reach their old age. And there's many species entwined together. The understory is full of massive logs that go to the height of this ceiling. And creatures live in and on and inside these logs. They're such an essential part, and they are the elders of the forest that have gone on. They're into the next generation. So just imagine, like, this forest that is just enormous and beyond most of our imaginations. Even I, when I get into these immense forests, I'm just awestruck. And that is where I grew up.
And it is quite an amazing journey she takes us on in this book, because it's also, it's the landscape of your childhood. And there are so many exquisite images of you collecting huckleberries with your brother, kind of digging right into that, the riding horses, camping in the woods, collecting your father's stories, your grandmother's stories. I'd like you to take us a little deeper into that and tell us about how those trees are woven with your family history.
Yeah, so my family moved across Canada from Quebec and into British Columbia in the late 1800s. And they were loggers in Quebec, horse loggers, and they carried on that trade in these rainforests of British Columbia. And so they lived right deep in the rainforest. And they had huge horses, actually not that many, two massive horses, and they had to be large enough, so they were about 3,000 pounds, just imagining the size of these horses, so that they could haul these massive logs. And so they set up this family operation, you know, just by trial and error in these mountains, made all of the tools by hand, fed their horses, you know, by hand using straw that they pulled in from the neighboring towns. The initial road was a wagon road, and my grandfather and my great-grandfather built flumes along the sides of the mountains where they were logging these massive trees with these horses and pulled these logs to these flumes and then sent them down into this big lake called Mabel Lake, which is where I spent a lot of my childhood on that lake. And then ultimately those logs were taken down this massive river called the Shuswap River, which is a First Nations name, and taken to a nearby mill and turned into various products eventually. But yeah, it was a very dangerous and very slow and deliberate way of making a living, but it was also a poor, we were not poor, we were not rich, we were quite poor, making just enough to raise the family.
So I am so glad that she has brought up that anecdote of the flume, because I was talking to a dear friend of mine just prior to this event, and the thing you need to know is we're sitting with one of the most important scientists of an epoch, but also a really literary voice that moves you in the way she writes every image. And that image of this huge timber falling, I'm just going to read you three sentences, if I may. The tree whooshed through the air, its crown catching the wind like a sail, creating such an eddy that the ferns below blew forward, revealing their pale undersides. Branches and needles swirling. In seconds, the tree landed with a deafening thud, the ground shuddering, limbs cracking like bones breaking, a nest of birds catching a draft and floating to the earth in a cloud of feathers. I just think you write like a dream. And I was so glad because this friend of mine before, he pulled out those three sentences, said, look at this. Anyway, your grandfather, great-grandfather, some very powerful influences. The gentleman that was missing a finger and missing an ear. Grandpa?
My grandfather, yeah. And my uncles, they all were missing fingers.
What did he teach you about the forest that you brought through to your professional life?
So much, you know, and I don't think that I really realized it as a kid how much I was learning just following him around. But he was a Frenchman. He'd been through as a logger, had many accidents. In fact, he was quite accident prone. One time he was out falling trees by himself, which is, you shouldn't do that, by the way. Anyway, this cedar tree fell down and swooshed and cut off his ear, and his ear was hanging by a skin, and he managed to get his boat because he had to cross the lake and then go up the river to get home. And my uncle Jack found him at home with his ear, you know, bleeding and hanging down on his neck, and he's going, "Dad," and he took him to the hospital, you know, with this one piece of skin hanging down, and somehow the doctors sewed it back on. And so he had an ear, but it was kind of awkward. Another time, he was out logging, and the tree fell on his back, and he broke his back. And so when I knew him as a child, he walked like this. So he was, you know, but he was still a logger, like just hunched over. And so I would follow him around, and he would, you know, to him the forest was, that was his family, right? He knew all the trees. He made little trails through the forest with his pickaxe. Everything was by hand. And when they were logging, he would pick out that one, like in a room like this, he'd pick out that one tree, and that would be the tree for the week that the loggers would go and cut that tree down, and then, of course, his horses would haul it to the flume. So it was very, very slow and deliberate.
Yeah, there's one picture in the book. The book has various family heirloom images in it, and there's one with these gentlemen standing on kind of steps stuck into the tree. Is that right? Yeah. How does that work? It's amazing.
There's springboards. So, yes. So the big cedar trees of the West Coast and the inland rainforest where I grew up, they have a curve to them. Kind of almost womanly, right? Like a woman's hips, and then the roots go out into the soil, and so they have, you know, they're straight and then they curve down like this, and also it snows, so the snow can be 3 or 4 meters deep, and so whether they're logging in the summer or the winter, they have to get above that curve or above the snow, and so they put these they chop in these little niches, really a little ledge into the wood, and then they put a board in, a springboard. It's called a springboard. one on each side, and a man would be on one side and a man on the other side with a crosscut saw, and they would spend about 3 or 4 days cutting down this one big tree, back and forth, back and forth. And I do describe that scene in the book about, you know, what it was like for my uncle and my grandfather to cut down a tree and, you know, smoking their Craven A's and eating their salmon jerky and eating the pie for lunch. And yeah, it evokes a lot of romance, I guess, about the forest, but it was very romantic.
Romantic, but also slow, measured, thoughtful, sustainable,
yeah,
intelligent work, and we'll move on to what that now isn't. But one thing that is this rooting to a place, it really is a very powerful theme in the first part of the book. It matters more than ever as we watch this horrific thing happening in Ukraine and the deracination of a people. But that feeling of belonging, you say, I can't tell if my blood is in the trees or if the trees are in my blood. And I think that's the sort of the foundation of the book, really, isn't it? Right, mm-hmm, at the start. But what you build on is this extraordinary ability to notice detail. And that comes from belonging to a place, I think. Mm-hmm. Would you tell us a little bit about the kind of development of that noticer's eye, your childhood, the sort of things some of those scenes where the tiny things we all miss, that you didn't just not miss, you ate them.
Yeah, I mean, when you live in a place, you know, that you go to every single day, and those trees are your family and your friends, you notice their home, and it's your home too. And all, you know, I knew every tree around my home, the birch tree and the fir tree and the cedar trees. And my brother and I would build forts, and we'd build trails through the forest. And so you get to know every plant, every tree, every rock. And so that's when I, you know, even as young as 3 or 4 or 5, playing in those forests, you get to know all those plants, and they're your friends. So that's how I built my skills of observation, I guess, that really helped me later in life, because I really do notice.
Tell us the story about the dog.
So we had a dog named Jigs, and Jigs is a beagle, a baying beagle, a curious beagle. He had big floppy ears, and he was always getting into trouble. So he's kind of like my Grandpa Henry, you know. Grandpa was always accident prone. Jigs was always getting into trouble. I think I follow in their footsteps because I'm always getting into trouble too. But anyway, one day Jigs was up in the forest, and we were in a logger's houseboat on the lake. And that logger's houseboat my grandfather had built. So loggers, lumberjacks, would stay in these houseboats. But we would holiday there every year. And so there was a gangplank that went onto the shore, and there was an outhouse up in the bush surrounded by trees. And one morning, we're getting up, and we hear this, oh, oh, and immediately we all knew Jigs had fallen in the outhouse. So my Uncle Wilfred, who was moored in another logger's houseboat about 100 meters away, comes running up the shore with his pickaxe, and my grandfather comes running down the gangplank, and we're all up there too. Jigs is in the outhouse! Jigs is in the outhouse! And my little brother especially was so excited. You know, he was probably, you know, about 4 years old, I was about 6. And so we run up there and fling open the outhouse door, and out come all these flies and all the stink, and there's Jigs down in the hole, baying, wanting to get out, of course. And so all of the Frenchmen were all around, and they start digging Jigs out because he was 6 feet down, and it was kind of wet down there. And so they started digging from the sides, and they dug and dug, and I just was fascinated. So I watched, you know, as they went through the roots and then the layers of the soil. And when you're watching something so dramatic, you start noticing things like the soil is actually like a layer cake when you actually start watching it. There's like a dark layer, and then a white layer, and then a yellow layer in these forests, and then a red layer, as red as a beating heart. And down at the bottom of that red beating heart was Jigs. And it took probably a few hours, and we finally got down to Jigs. And we're trying to pull him out by his paws, and had to dig further and further. And then my uncle and grandfather pulled him out covered in toilet paper. And off, you know, I took Jigs down to the lake and we went for a swim.
But that incident was a moment where you were going right into these networks in the earth. And it is, I don't know how many of you know that wonderful book by James Wood, The Art of Fiction. He talks about you've got to be a good noticer of things to be a great writer. And this is the extraordinary thing with Suzanne, because she is that literary thing of being a great noticer of things, but paired with science. And this is where the book kind of comes alive in this very, very original space. And the linking between this lockstep between family and your scientific discoveries, which we will move on to. I just want everybody to really feel the roots that Suzanne has in the forest and makes so powerful the sense of place in that early part of the book. But I would like to ask you about some of the relationships with family that you weave with those interconnections in the forest societies, your sister, your parents, your friend, your ex-husband, your kids, your partner. Not one of those relationships is stronger or lesser than another. You treat them with equal respect and compassion. She says in the acknowledgements, this is a love song to your family, and you do that so kindly. But what I would like to ask you is one relationship which really sticks like a burr, and it's your brother, Kelly, the rodeo cowboy. Mm-hmm. Can you explain that relationship a little and how you draw from it to build some really key themes in the narrative of this book?
Yeah, so like me, my brother was a person of the land. And, you know, he really loved horses. And the reason he loved horses is because, you know, we were settler families. We settled in the Monashee Mountains on both sides of the family. And that means that we, you know, it's a land of First Nations, of Aboriginal people, Indigenous people. Settlers came and built farms and ranches, and they logged the forest to make these farms and ranches. And horses were involved all the time, and cowboys. And Kelly fell in love with the cowboy life. I fell in love with the forestry life, but they were interwoven together. You know, that was really the same life of the land, just expressed in different ways. And so Kelly and I shared that deep, deep love of looking after the land. But he was interested in horses and cowboying, and he followed in my Uncle Charles's footsteps and my Uncle Wayne, who were both ranchers. And eventually he became a farrier and a blacksmith and a cowboy. So he herded cows for a living. And so we were bonded together by this shared love. And we were, you know, we grew up together like this. We were, you know, brother and sister, really, really tight. But then, you know, as you get older and you start to find your own way, we sort of diverged a little bit. And I was trying to build a career as a young woman in a man's world, which was forestry, and there were very few of us. And my brother was in this man's world that I always thought was like from a century ago. It was the old times. He loved the old ways of being on the land, of riding horses, of being out there for days at a time. And so his thinking was shaped more and more by that, about herding cattle. And he started to, you know, become one of the cows, like bulls and cows. And do you want me to go on with this story?
Well, I find it, what is very present in your book is silence.
Yeah.
The silence of the forest, sometimes it's solace. The silence, your relationship with Mary when the phone goes, it's a beautiful, beautiful line, where the silence between two people who connect, but what no word needs to be spoken. You lost your brother in a tragic accident, but his silence is so loud in the book. And that was what I wanted to sort of just draw out, because these relationships that you thread through your science and through the narrative, they kind of resonate with each other. They're doing exactly what we're going to get onto, which is the heart of your discovery. But that's I just kind of want to communicate to everybody in the room, this weaving is so sophisticated between the echo and family and your professional work. Your career, forester to scientist. Now, come on, you're a woman. I've spent a little bit of time in Canada. How tough was that as a forester prior to your science?
It was bloody tough. Yeah, it was really hard. I mean, so even though I grew up in a family of foresters, women didn't do forestry. It's never something I imagined I would be able to do. And there were women weren't really allowed into the profession, and I didn't even know what forestry was. I had no idea, but I eventually did happen to stumble on that in university. And at the time, they had just opened the doors to let the first girls into the faculty to study forestry. And so, you know, all the young men that were in the classes and the professors, they were you know, very proud of, they were very macho, and, you know, they were basically lumberjacks that had just gone up one step further. And it was very rough and ready, and the girls were really, you know, we didn't really belong. but we stayed, we stuck with it in spite of, you know, I remember this one professor, he would... as an example, and I don't write about this in the book, but he loved the ginkgo tree, right? And the ginkgo leaf is like, you know, there's a stem, and then there's like, you know, it looks, and he would hold it up and he would say, what does this remind you of? And all the girls would go, oh my God, do we have to endure this again? And he would go, you know, it would go on and on. But somehow, in spite of all the jokes and the sexism and the trying to get rid of us, we stuck with it. And yeah.
It is the silence again. There's this one moment where it went a bit wrong in the forest and your vehicle gets stuck and you're overnight with the bears and you come back in and you're waiting for the bollocking and instead the calendar drops from the wall. It's just such a good moment and it's just, you don't need words. It's a tiny little moment to break that agonizing silence. But we'll get to where the voice, the activist, comes out in due course. I want to now get into something that is this really key epiphany moment for you. And I'm going to go back to something which is, I've been reading alongside your book, rereading it alongside your book, which is E.O. Wilson, Letters to a Young Scientist, which I just think is a most magnificent, it's got magnificent advice to a young scientist. And it says, he writes, look especially for oddities, small deviations and phenomena that seem trivial at first, but on closer examination might prove important. Build scenarios in your head when scanning information available to you. Make use of puzzlement. I want you to explain your puzzlement. What was that moment for you?
You know, I think I always kind of was looking for... So I was in this forest industry that was tearing down our old growth forests and still is today, and replacing them with these plantations, tree farms. And I was so puzzled by why would anybody want to do that? So there was that puzzle. I wanted to solve that puzzle because I knew it was what we were doing was so destructive, self-destructive. And so I started, and of course I loved the soil. I ate dirt from the moment I could, you know, grew up. It was always a fascination with me, and I knew what was going wrong was in the soil. And so I started looking at those details of the soil, like I described those layers. I also noticed things like, you know, there's all these creatures that live in the soil. They make holes. They run along roots. There are fungi that run through the soil and form threads like gauze. And there are creatures living on and in them. And it's fascinating. And I started to look at those details and realize that what we were doing is we were ripping that whole society, that organized system, apart. And that was where my curiosity led me, is what is it that we're ripping apart? We don't even know what we're ripping apart. And so that's where I went into my discovery, is to try to figure out what that thing was.
So can you tell us about the magical dance between the paper birch and the Douglas fir and that experiment?
Yeah. So just starting, going back to what the foresters were doing, was taking these complex, diverse, beautiful ecosystems and simplifying them down to, say, Douglas fir. And Douglas fir, or pine, or spruce, was earning people huge amounts of money, massive amounts of money in cutting these magical forests down. And so they were planted back with the idea that if we can just get rid of all those other species and just have Douglas fir, just think how rich we'll be. I mean, it really was that simple. And so they were, foresters were putting back magnificent mixed forests with Douglas fir and spraying with herbicides species like birch and weeding out the cedars. And really the diversity was just ending up in these big burn piles that would be burned up. And that was making the forest sick. And so I started to look at, what if, you know, you left the birch? Maybe the forest won't be so sick. Maybe the birds will be there. Maybe the squirrels will come back. And so I started to look at, and I realized, too, in looking at the natural patterns, that the firs were healthier when the birches were there and the cedars were there. And so I started looking below ground at these linkages, and I thought, oh, my God, they're, you know, I eventually learned that they were linked together in this fungal network, this gauze that underlays the forest floor, and that they're connected. And I started labeling them with isotopes, which was always a fascination of mine. What if I followed where things went from tree to tree, and I learned how to use carbon-14 and carbon-13 and N-15, all these different isotopes you can use as tracers. And I remember going to my PhD advisor and saying, what if we did this? And he said, that would be really hard to do. But I did it, and I saw where it went. And it turns out that Douglas fir and paper birch were trading carbon back and forth between each other. And that completely upended what we were doing with these birch, getting rid of them, because we thought that the foresters thought, oh, they're competing, they're shading these Douglas firs. We've got to get rid of them, spray them, get rid of these awful things. But it turns out that the more they shaded the Douglas fir, the more carbon they sent to the Douglas fir. And so it kept Douglas fir in the ecosystem, and that they were in a dance that maintained diversity of the forest.
It's so exciting, the magical dance, because what you're saying is these things are cooperating, yeah, not competing. And that was heretical to the scientific community. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. And another way to think of it is that they have this very complex relationship, right? They're communicating with each other in a myriad of ways. And yes, they compete for sure. You know, the birch does shade Douglas fir. That's what we think of as competition. But at the same time, they're cooperating by sending them carbon and providing nitrogen for, you know, through support of bacterial microbiofilms. It's this complex conversation. So that was what I was unraveling, and I forget what the point of your question was.
No. I'm going to just keep on building out from there, because the weave of the book, I'm slightly pulling it from the back, but the mother tree. Can you just talk about that concept of the mother tree and what you mean by that very powerful phrase?
Yeah. So forests have structure, right? There's big trees and little trees. There's all different species. Even within a species, there's a huge variation in how fast they grow, how tall they grow. And so just like in this, you know, group of people, you all have different heights and characteristics and personalities. It's the same in forests. And so in what I did is that in trying to uncover what this network looked like, the fungal threads that link trees together, we actually dissected a forest that was a natural primary forest with all different ages by rolling back the forest floor and looking at all the fungal connections between the trees. And what we found is that everything was connected to everything else. All the trees were interconnected in multiple ways, right? This, if I was connected to you, I'd have like 100 linkages to you through all my different roots, and 100 to you, and 1,000 to you. And the bigger the tree is, the more linkages there is, because there's more roots. And so the bigger trees also have big crowns, and they photosynthesize huge amounts of carbon. They're shoveling massive amount of energy down into the soil, feeding into the roots and through these mycorrhizal networks, and feeding the entire forest. So it was at that moment of making the map, I realized these big trees were so essential in the forest. They were the big connectors. And that they actually, through these connections, nurtured their youngsters. They nurtured the seedlings coming up around them. And that's what led us to realize that these were really mother trees.
So they recognize their own kin.
They do.
It's just so bizarre.
It is, but is it?
Well, as I'm reading it, you have this parallel with your own family, and you're walking through the forest with your daughter, passing on that wisdom. That's where it just resonates with me, because I'm not a scientist. And that's what the art of this book is. You have this constant metaphor running with those familial relationships. You know, some of the people that help her on her experiments are her father and your partner. It's you've got everyone involved, as well as a great number of researchers that I admire how much she recognized and named them through the book. What I would like to ask you is the sort of this resistance you got. You're a doctoral student, I believe, when that research is first put out, and it goes in Nature magazine, which in the context of your world is is a very big noise. I think you got the cover, is that right, in 97? Yeah. But what happened out there? How did people respond to it?
Yeah, it was actually the first paper I'd ever published in my life. I finished my doctoral thesis, and my brother passed away soon afterwards, after I finished my dissertation, and I thought, I just couldn't do anything, right? I was paralyzed. And then my committee and my supervisor says, you need to publish this work. And so I ended up sending the main paper to Nature, and they rejected it at first, and then they accepted it. And then when it was published, there was this big backlash, and I was not expecting it at all. I was grieving. I was actually having my first child, and then the backlash against the academic world just hit me like a tsunami. And it was like, you know, I think it was because there was so much vested intellectually in the idea that competition drives evolution and drives ecology that people had built careers around this. And it's not that it's not important, it is, but there's more to it than that. And even Darwin knew there was more to it than that, but the academic world was not ready to change its mind yet. And so I got this huge backlash that I was not expecting at this very vulnerable time of my life. And then the forest community also had really invested in this idea that competition was so important. All the forestry practices, agriculture practices, were designed around managing competition. And so there was a huge industry, a herbicide industry, a thinning industry. You know, the forest industry was all designed to hold up this idea. And so the backlash there was huge. It was like being hit with another tsunami. And yeah, so I actually got to the point where I thought, I can't do this anymore.
I remember being pregnant and not being able to take on any argument. I just couldn't cope with that combative sort of approach. You were just about to have, I think, your first child. That backlash kind of silenced you. And then you had an interview with, I think, a Globe and Mail journalist, and you let something slip you maybe shouldn't have let slip, though thank God you did. Five words. What was it?
She asked me, is it good that they're getting rid of birches and aspens and the biodiversity from ecosystems? And I said, and I was very pregnant. I was a week from having my child. And I said, for all the good they're doing, they might as well paint rocks. And then I was sitting in my office and I'm going, I wonder if that was a good thing to say. And I went over to my supervisor, Alan Weiss, who I absolutely adored and still adore him to this day. And I said, Alan, you know, I just had this interview. And I told him, and he goes, oh, my God. And he got on the phone, and he phoned the reporter, and he said, can you please not print that? And she said, well, I can't promise you. And then it ended up on the front page of the Globe and Mail.
I love that journalist for breaking her own off-record rules, I have to say, because it did unleash the activist and the voice out of that period of quiet and silence and withdrawal and mourning. And the book now takes on a different pace as this kind of activist voice starts to evolve. One thing I'd like to ask you, because this really is a book that resonated with me as a female reader, but you're careful not to manipulate gender politics in the book that turns into any kind of rant about a male-dominated world that you've occupied as a female scientist and a forester. But I can still feel the intractability. How difficult was it really to break that gender wall?
Really hard. And the gender wall still exists, but the ceiling is getting higher and higher. And so more and more women are getting into higher and higher positions. But you won't find a CEO of a logging company, and you won't find a minister of forest that's female. And you won't find, a dean in a university in Canada that's a female. You know, there is still a very solid ceiling there. And it's really important to get women into those positions, because that's when you get fundamental change. And we haven't gotten there yet. We're still in the old ages. And we just actually hired a new dean, and a woman applied. And I was like, yes. And she had all these great ideas, and the faculty couldn't do it, just couldn't go there. And so we hired a male dean who happens to be one of the most progressive deans that we have ever had there. But still, it just shows that we're still not quite there.
There was that one scene with a tall male scientist, you don't name him, he's just tall. And you're in a forest with a tall man, and he humiliates you.
Yeah.
What was his line? Miss Birch.
Yeah.
I mean, anyway, it's fierce. Because as you're reading this, it's a really sophisticated feminist book, I think. That's how I read it. It's a woman's story, a love letter to your children, your grandmother, your mother. The mama bears that are every so often popping up in the chapters, the mother tree. It's a call to arms, to be brave, to embrace risk, believe in your intuition, all of those things. But here's a question, which is an intimate one, balancing that massive career, massive celebrity, with motherhood. How difficult was it, and is it, to pull off?
Yeah, it was so hard. You know, and I think I wanted to write about that because I wanted to reach out to women, especially, you know, as a scientist in academia or in forestry or in the profession, you can see women just like, we can't even talk about it. Right, we're so worried of losing our jobs and losing everything that we tried to gain, and being the first professor in my faculty was in 1990. Right, that was only 20, 30 years ago, and that woman is still there. And you can imagine what she had to go through to get there. And she is so stern. I mean, she's a very, very lovely and beautiful person, but she will not let herself, you know, be emotional or, you know, express her womanhood. And I really wanted to break that open a little bit for women, to allow us to be ourselves a little bit, to give us permission to be ourselves and bring our full selves to the table, to the science, because it really is important that we see, because we see things a little bit differently, and we need that full picture. You know, the forest needs that full picture. So yeah, it was a goal of mine to try and express that, but not so on the nose.
Well, you do. I mean, you describe also in very practical terms these 9-hour commutes between your academic life and your private life, and, you know, huge. And there's one where you're looking forward to the sabbatical to be with your daughters in a more complete way. And you say, until that magical year, I'd spirit across the mountains each weekend to reabsorb their lives, my motherhood, like time-lapse photography. So beautiful. That's why I love this book. It's so beautiful. It's so moving.
Thank you.
It really is. I've got to be conscious of time because we've got questions. Okay, so I need to just slightly move on a little bit. The other place where I think I feel the female strand is in the strong theme of healing. You get cancer, and a particular group of people hold you. Mm-hmm. And teach you, and it resonates also with your science. Can you talk through that a little for us?
Yeah, you know, like, cancer is a very scary thing. Any life-threatening disease is terrifying, and it's not something you want to go through alone. I mean, you know, we are individuals, and we are born alone, I guess. We live alone, we die alone, but that's not totally true. You know, we are a collective. We are our relationships with each other. And even though I felt alone in that diagnosis of cancer, what I did is I connected with the other women going through chemotherapy, and we formed a group, a network, and we still are. You know, it's been 10 years, and I mean, there's a text on my phone right now from a couple of them saying, "How's it going over there? We're so close." And it turns out that that closeness, that connection, is a strong healing aspect of recovering from illness like cancer. And it's the same in forests. you know, one of the things I went on to discover with my students is that when old trees or even young trees are injured or ill, that they send messages back and forth to their neighbors, and the neighbors get those messages. It's actually a chemical, they're defense enzymes that transmit through these mycorrhizal networks that then are picked up by the neighboring trees, which then they get that message, they upregulate their RNA, and they start developing, or they start manufacturing defense enzymes, or they're encoded to produce more of these defense enzymes. And then those plants can defend themselves against the enemy that they've been warned about by their neighbor, their mother tree, or their child in the forest. And then when in our experiments, we challenged those upregulated trees with that disease again, and they were resistant. And we found out that not only was that seedling resistant, but the next generation from it, its offspring were resistant, and their offspring were resistant. So it carried on through the generations, these messages. So you know, that connection in forests, it's the same in humans, and that is why I think I and my cancer buddies, we're all alive, we're all fine, we all made it through, and that was one of the key things, is our connection.
It's that really, the phrase you use, we're built for recovery. Yeah. And ultimately, I find this book very life-affirming. I find it very optimistic. But the state of our forests is not. How do you balance those two things? Because I feel your optimism and your compassion wanting to win, but in reality, where do you think our forests are going?
You know, the great thing about forests is that they're regenerative, and these healing networks, they're real, they self-organized to regenerate. And yes, I mean, our forests are in trouble, and, you know, thanks to us. So for a number of reasons. So we're still cutting down primary forests. We're still cutting down old growth forests to do things like make cardboard and toilet paper, which is ridiculous, right? Why would you take a beautiful 2,000-year-old tree and turn it into an Amazon package that you can send halfway around the world? It's crazy, but we're doing that. And in sacrificing these forests, we're releasing massive amounts of carbon into the atmosphere. And that's the second cause next to fossil fuel burning for climate change. So we're in this vicious feedback loop. So what gives me hope, though, is that we know what to do. We know how to do this better, you know.
But are they listening? Is policy changing as a result?
It's really slow, but you know what's happening is that there's a number of people who are vocal. And like this audience, you guys, for example, nobody would listen to me 10 years ago or 5 years ago. You know, it's like, who, you know, that's ridiculous. But you're listening. You care, right? And that is where the movement happens. There's a movement happening, and that movement is making the governments and making the companies to wake up, and they're starting to listen too. So in Canada, we do nothing but clear cutting, but I was just talking to one of the main foresters in British Columbia, and they said, we're not going to clear cut anymore. We're going to leave the old mother trees. That's a massive change, right? I've never seen a change like that in an instant like that. And it's because the public is pressuring governments to do a better job because we're scared, right? And we want a future, and we want our kids to be able to live their lives and have healthy, fruitful lives. So it's really up to all of us to listen and move, act.
But we're also animals that need stories. Stories are the thing that endures and persuades. And I'm just before we turn to the floor for some questions, I'm fascinated about the process of writing, because half of your life is in academia with all its complex thinking, terminology, dryness, dare I say. And then this other heart side of you, your soul is in the forest and in my mind in poetry. How do you flip between those two things? How was that process of writing this book?
You know, I wanted to be a writer when I was a kid, and I had a little bit of a talent for it. Although, you know, I went down the practical side because I needed a job. My mom always says, you've got to have a job. And so I went into forestry because I could get a job, and I didn't think I could as a writer. And so I had that in me, but then I became a scientist. And when you write science, it's like writing a recipe book. You know, there's a prescription. And to be a good science writer, you've got to follow that prescription, because scientists, when they pick up a journal article or they have a stack, you know, I've got to read 30 articles in order to write this paper, you've got to get through them really quickly and absorb it. And so there's a recipe for it. You know, first you write the abstract and it's structured this way. Then you write the introduction, it's structured this way, and objectives, they're stuck, and then the methods. And so it's a very prescripted process. And I just felt like I was in a straitjacket, and I wanted, and also nobody reads them except other scientists. And I knew that I had a story here. And so I thought, wouldn't it be lovely to write a book that brings this desire to write creatively and rekindle that in myself and bring the science that I so wanted everybody to know, because it was so important for us to know this stuff, and bring it into a book that when you're reading it, you don't have to work at the science to understand it. You read the story and you go, oh, I happened to learn the science along the way. So that was what
that's
I was trying
me.
To
do. That's exactly what was happening. But, you know, you're like this. What this book has done is you're like the mother tree of a kind of whole canopy of new stories, new books that are coming out, all massively codependent upon that earth wire, which you have given us with this life story. That's what's so important within the pages of this. I'd like to, at this moment in time, I think, be generous and interconnected and ask the floor if there's any questions that we might have. Hi.
Thank you so much. This has just been fascinating. So much of what you said resonates with me, because my family's had a cabin in northern Minnesota on national forest land for 4 generations now. Yeah. So at least in the summertime, I felt like I lived close to the earth, and our family dog also fell down the outhouse. So
that's awesome.
But my question really has to do with fire, because we've just had devastating wildfires this summer in northern Minnesota, which used to have some of the cleanest air in the continental United States, had air quality indexes worse than any place on Earth because of these really terrible wildfires. Mm-hmm. And we've recently been talking with forest rangers about some of the managing fire better. So for 100 years, we've just had this policy of fire suppression, mm-hmm. and now there's all this fuel on the ground, and that combined with record droughts leads to these crazy fires. Yeah. Well, the Native American population, they used to do deliberate fire setting every 5 years or so to sort of clear the understory and make farms with combined plants. And they had these practices that meant that you didn't have these out-of-control fires.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm wondering whether there's any talk about adopting sort of good fire practices in Canada, whether you see there's any way forward with that.
It's a huge conversation in North America, and I mean it, and it should be. It probably is around the world, but you're right. Like, the suppression of fire, it has caused massive fuel buildups, which, you know, with all that fuel and the heat, and also the heat creating more ignition sources, lightning, we've created this catastrophe. And so there is a lot, you know, there is a lot of talk about prescribed burning, you know, and there we definitely need to go there. And we're starting. The problem is that we also have a big population that's grown in and among those forests, and there's a lot of private property, you know. And it's interesting because the Native Americans or the First Nations, the concept of private property, which is kind of a tangential thing, there was no private property, right? It was the land, and we looked after the land. But now we've got private property and boundaries, and so those need to be respected. Otherwise, you know, there'll be social chaos as people try to protect them, their chattels and their lives, and so that needs to be managed so that we don't have a social crisis. And so that means that we can't just do prescribed burning as it has to be done extremely carefully to protect all those interests. It's got to be done. It's a science, right? It's a very special and precise science, and we need more and more people to understand that. And it's even in a lot of areas we won't be able to do that. So there's alternatives where you go and use mechanical means to clear out the understory to protect villages, because if those fires take off and get into the crown under these heat domes, it's catastrophic.
Yeah.
And the fires burn more severely, they're more extensive than they were historically, so they're damaging to the ecosystems, whereas they were always regenerative to the ecosystem. So we have to be extremely careful, but you know, humans can and will play a role in reintroducing fire to reinvigorate our ecosystems.
Well, I'm glad some of those conversations are happening.
They are, but I mean, we've got a long way to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks. We'll be over here.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. As a male reader of the book, I just want to say I hugely enjoyed it. I thought it was incredibly moving.
Thank you.
There's something there for the poets and the scientists. And so any male readers out there, definitely I urge you to read it. So my question comes to, I don't know if people in the room have read The Overstory and know about that book from 2017, which won the Pulitzer Prize and really transformed a fictional landscape around trees becoming characters. And there's discussion, obviously, I think, that the main character, one of the main characters in the book, Dr. Patricia Westerford, is based on you. And there's also talk, obviously, the film The Avatar, that might have had some connection to your work. Mm. We have a film of your life coming out. Mm-hmm. You're your own fictional hero in your book. And, you know, for anyone that's under any illusion, this is a little bit potentially like sitting in the room in 1850s with Charles Darwin meeting Tim Berners-Lee with the Wood Wide Web. So we're huge. It, you know, the scale of her achievements are along those lines will probably be recognised. So I'd like to ask you what it's like now to have been, with respect to a sort of an unknown scientist, that suddenly catapulted into this arena of being an inspirer of fiction, of poetry, of film.
It's beyond belief. I mean, honestly, I grew up a shy little kid. I sucked my thumb till I was 12. I ate dirt till I was 5, you know. So and my expectations were never that great. I just followed my grandpa around. And so that all of this, it's wonderful, and it's so much fun to meet all of you and talk to all of you and have, you know, these great discussions and see the inspiration. My main drive is still, though, for the forest, right? The forest is where our lives are interdependent with the forest, and that's my home, and my kids are dependent on that. So all of this is, you know, it's fantastic because you're all engaged, too, and I can see the love in your eyes and your conversations, and you want the same things, and that energizes me, and all the other stuff. It's great, but the main thing that drives me is life on Earth and making a safe and lovely life without suffering for our children.
Yeah. I remember there was a little moment right early on where I can't remember whether you were you had a boyfriend or something, but there was one line where you go, I want to be somebody. Oh, it was like, it was so humble in its context. You need to read to see. But it was like, I just felt that kind of, this like glimmer that then turns into this moment where she talks about, I made a promise. And I think this is just out of memory. You say, to get the word out for the trees that don't speak. But by the end of the book, you think the trees do speak. Yeah. It's a sort of build of conviction. That sort of takes you on this sort of tidal wave of belief as you get through, as you work through the book. Any other questions? Lots. Sorry, I can't quite see with the shining lights.
Oh, hi. I just have one quick question. What organizations, either in the UK or the US, would you recommend supporting that are doing this kind of work or building on your work to promote diversity of forests? And just have one other question. Did you read The Lorax as a small child?
Of course. Yeah. Well, there's lots of really great organizations and, you know, that are trying to approach this problem from various angles. So I can give you a few names. So Canopy Planet, for example, is trying to work with supply chains to clean up supply chains so that we're not actually harvesting old growth forests to make stuff that we don't really need. So that's one really, you know, if you're going to support someone, that's a really good one. In Western Canada, there's another organization called the Ancient Forest Alliance, and their goal is to save the ancient forests. In the Amazon, there's another organization called the Amazon Sacred Headwaters Initiative, which is trying to save the sacred headwaters of Ecuador and Peru, because once those forests collapse, you know, we're all going to be in trouble, and they are within about 5 years of collapsing. So there are, you know, the Greenpeace is another great organization, Sierra Club. There's quite a few of them. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. I'm another male reader who really enjoyed and loved your book, but my question is really, half the population of the world now are urban dwellers, and nature connectedness is a real issue, I think, for them. Do you have any advice for us urban dwellers and how we can reconnect with nature in an effective way?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that you're here means that you are already, but lots of people aren't, and I think that, you know, just spending time with a tree, I mean, really, it's like meditating, right? When you meditate, it's like you start doing it, your mind goes off in a million directions, and, you know, you're thinking about all the stuff that you're not supposed to be, and then suddenly you get into that space, and you go, oh, I get it. You don't lose that. And it's the same connecting with trees and plants and forests, is just go there and spend time. Just be silent with the tree and lean against that tree and feel it. And then you're connected, and you never lose that connection. And then once you have that, you can, you know, that love will never go away. And then you can put that into action. And so my advice to urban dwellers is just go out there and just spend time and turn off your cell phone and maybe lay on the forest floor. This is what I get my students to do, you know, at UBC. You know, a lot of the students come from Asia, and they've never been in a forest before. They're from Shanghai or Beijing or Hong Kong, and unfortunate for them, they've never been there. I take them in the forest, and they're like really nervous at first, and they're like, where's my phone? And oh my God, I gotta listen to... And then we just sit there for 5 minutes, and they start to calm down. They stop fidgeting, and their heartbeats, I'm sure, go down. Mine does. And we start listening to the birds and the squirrels and the bugs. And by the end of the course, they can't wait to get back out there every week, because I take them out there every single week, and we just do that every time. And then they're hooked. And then they become the champions of the forest from then on.
You're so modest, because... in that forest, there's just a bear behind every tree. And half the time, she's running up them. So in our English, Oakland, where I think we're in safe territory. But yeah, very, very good question. Any others?
Thank you very much for your book. It's really wonderful.
Thank you.
But even more important, thank you for being you.
Oh, thank you.
I think that's really wonderful. I can't echo more than what was said before. I have a question for you. there is a technique which is growing in terms of planting trees in a way, planting saplings in a different way, where they're trying to plant intensively. So you're talking about 4 or 5 saplings per square meter of multi-species. Mm-hmm. Would you like to comment on that? Because that's quite an intensive way of planting. And what you think of that in terms of reforestation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a couple of concepts there. One is the diversity of species. And, you know, it's important to know what the natural diversity is there, you know, and what form of diversity that is. We often think of species diversity, but there's genetic diversity, there's structural diversity, but diversity in general matters. And the reason it matters, if we think of, say, the biogeochemical cycles, which is at a much bigger scale, it happens at a bigger scale, but it's really local in where it's activated, and that's right in that structurally diverse forest. And so how it works is if you have if you have 5 species versus 1, those 5 species occupy different layers of the canopy above ground and then the canopy below ground, the root canopy. And in so doing, they capture light and resources at different pools in the soil, in that resource profile. And by more fully capturing the resources, they're able to actually put on more growth and they store more carbon. And they're also more resistant in case there's some kind of injury or infestation or infection in the area. At least one of those species will survive. And so it's important from a productivity point of view and a carbon sequestration and storage point of view, and also resistance and resilience to damage in forests. So diversity really matters. The other point you made was about planting species densely together. And it depends on where you are, you know. So some species, like aspen, for example, naturally grows in very dense stands. You can go into an aspen, young aspen stand, and there'll be 10,000 stems per hectare. That means that there's, a tree every few centimeters. And that's natural for that stand, and it will self-thin over time, where it will become more widely spaced. But we have to be really careful not to take that to the extreme in all ecosystems, because when you plant really densely, you can actually, for example, in fire-prone ecosystems, if they're planted densely together, it can actually spread fire more quickly if it's the wrong place. And we're actually making those mistakes in North America right now, right? Because, we get sort of on this wrong-headed path. We'll say, if we just plant more trees, then, if some die, then at least there'll be some left. But we're actually creating a very dense stand that fire propagates through very quickly. And so it's really important to understand the ecosystem, the local ecosystem, and what naturally works there, the diversity of the species and the spacing. Not everything will work the same way everywhere. Yeah.
Hi, I've got a question. I was just wondering, you're talking about mother trees. Is there any possibility of a father tree?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And no disrespect to all the fathers out there. The reason I call them mother trees is just because of that regenerative aspect of the old trees nurturing their young. It's almost like it's a metaphor. In most tree species, the mothers and fathers are in the same tree. You'll have female cones and male cones right on the same tree. There are exceptions. The yew tree, for example, there is male and female trees. But the idea of the nurturing capacity of old trees is what I was trying to get at. So they can be, mothers and fathers in the same tree. And I'll just add one more point that, in our indigenous cultures across the world, there's a recognition of mother trees and father trees and grandmother trees and grandfather trees. All those terms are used across cultures because these old trees have long been recognized to play such important roles in connecting the forest. It's been known for a long, long, long time.
And the father of your children in the book, Doug, he's a huge presence of connectedness and nurture with your 2 beautiful girls. So
yes.
It all ties and resonates like this extraordinary fungal web. Have we got time for any more? One over
Hi.
Here.
Hi. I just wanted, sorry, I'm in the dark.
Oh, hi. It's very blinding, the light.
I know. It's really hard. I just want to say once again, thank you so much. Your work has deeply impacted my work in a very bizarre way. I work on mega projects. I say this very carefully in this sort of room, which is like big infrastructure projects. But it's really influenced how I see the systems of people who work on those projects and how we need to change the way we work. And for me, I suppose this conversation about male, female, et cetera, I almost see it as a conversation more about something to do with finding our Indigenous souls or speaking to our Indigenous souls and the patterns of how regenerative work works. And I just sort of wonder about, you know, is it that we need to reconnect to patterns of our lives or see it through a systems viewpoint rather than a male-female divide?
Yeah, it's about connection, right? And I'd be interested to know about your project. Maybe we can talk about it afterwards. It sounds interesting. But not to get distracted by that, but that the Indigenous part of it, it's how we see the world that's so important, right? My Indigenous colleagues, their whole way of seeing the world is that, you know, that it's to cultivate the world, to nurture it, to look after it, and there are cultural institutions that make sure that is carried on through the generations, and there's status in you know, in nations like chiefdoms, and that they have that responsibility, those obligations to look after the salmon and look after the bears and the wolves and look after the people. And if you slip up, you lose that status. And so it's in the culture, it's a worldview, and you know, somehow we all have Indigenous roots, you know, and we need to get back and remember that's what it's about. It's not about exploiting our Mother Earth. It's about caring for our Mother Earth, and that is the worldview that we are all connected and we're interdependent. That is what we need to remember, yeah. So thanks for that comment.
So I think, unfortunately, we're time up. I would like to say to you, you're just a gift.
Thank you.
Book is a gift, your science a gift, your prose is a gift. So thank you for being so generous with that fierce intelligence and that compassion. Thank you, I think, from all of us. You're magnificent.
This episode starred Suzanne Simard, and the host was Sophie Roberts. It was produced by the How To Academy and Freddie Matthews from The Conduit. You'll find more Conduit conversations on all major podcast platforms. Please do subscribe. And for more information about The Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.